lapped her cheeks to get back into character and was just about to step inside when she felt the calm crystal on her belt vibrate. This was unexpected, as there should have been at least a few more minutes before Fort Yemen's defenders were supposed to fall back and retreat. It wasn't until the shapeshifter took the item out that it realized it wasn't Kira's comm crystal vibrating, but the Sandman's.
Phew. That was close, it sighed internally. I was so distracted I almost answered it with the wrong face on. I should really start labeling these things like that Underwood guy.
In retrospect, it really should have expected this. The Republic's officers had demanded the password to that particular comm crystal the day before to better coordinate with the mysterious Sandman during the siege. It was only natural that they would want to have a word after what had gone down on the outside. Deciding it would be bad for business if it kept them waiting, Boxy quickly changed character and answered the call, causing the familiar face of Silas Underwood to project from the comm crystal.
"Hello, Mr. Underwood,"
it said in a displeased tone. The elf on the other end furrowed his brows for a moment before confirming today's passphrase.
In brightest day, in blackest night.
I shan't stop tickling bums with all my might.
Hello, Sandman. You know, I honestly wish you'd pick more decent words for these.
Never mind that, Boxy growled. What do you want? I'm busy.
You've been busy indeed, haven't you? That's exactly why I'm calling. Just so we're on the same page, you did remove the warlock VIP that attacked you, yes?
Yes. He's dead.
Ah, good. Very good,
Underwood said with obvious relief. It would seem the intelligence officer needed additional confirmation regarding that warlock's fate. Although one of his scouts had been keeping an eye on the Sandman, he failed to see much of their battle since it kicked up a huge amount of dust and smoke. The grunt didn't even realize the vigilante's opponent was a ranker until that large-scale ultimate skill was revealed, at which point many sets of eyes were gathered on them. As a result, there were numerous reports of the cloaked mercenary somehow shrugging off the immense gravity and catching his opponent by surprise, then strangling and stabbing the life out of him. The human's presumably dead body had disappeared somewhere under the Sandman's cloak, and the vigilante vanished several seconds later, just before that gilded hand bruiser arrived at the scene.
I won't ask how or why, the elf continued, but you have the Republic's gratitude.
I can't eat gratitude.
Indeed. That's why I have been authorized to offer you a deal. Shinji Arakawa should have had a necklace on him, a silver one with an orange gemstone in it. If it is in your possession, then the Republic would very much want to take it off your hands. For a generous reward, of course.
The Sandman went silent. While it was true that more money was definitely a good thing, it did not want to pass up on uniquely shiny things so easily. That's why it still held on to things like that bum's golden skeleton, as well as the Profanus Gloria, the cursed chalice that it had created a while back. Besides, if the Republic wanted it, then perhaps this was a magic item of some power. Boxy hadn't confirmed its effects, but if this was an artifact, or maybe even...
Since you are mulling it over, then am I to understand the item in question is in your possession?
The elf's words completely derailed the monster's train of thought. That Underwood fellow managed to get a read on Boxy's thoughts just from that brief moment of silence. The shapeshifter had always been wary of his sharp intuition, which was why it wanted to avoid talking with him as much as possible. Unfortunately, asking for another point of contact was no longer an option. Even if the Republic leadership agreed, Underwood would definitely listen in on the conversations anyway.
Yes, I have it, it admitted, and I would be happy to take you up on your offer.
If the Republic wanted this thing, then perhaps handing it over was for the best. The last thing Boxy wanted was for them to start hunting the Sandman over a trinket of dubious origins. It just didn't seem to be worth the trouble, and the payout would likely be enough to soothe its collector's spirit.
Very good,
the intelligence officer nodded.
Now, this reward you mentioned...
We will need to discuss that at a later date,
Underwood interrupted.
While we want the item, it is by no means urgent. This is neither the time nor the place for negotiations.
That is so, the shapeshifter conceded.
Therefore, I would like to ask that you safeguard the treasure for the moment.
Then, I shall take my leave of this battlefield and contact you a few days from now. Assuming you still live, of course.
Of course,
the elf replied with a wry smile.
I shall look forward to that day. Underwood out.
The intelligence officer cut off the connection, and the blue-tinged image of a head cloaked in rags disappeared from his palm. He went back to organizing what was left of the 1st Scouting Battalion. Even if the snipers in the treetops had the element of surprise at first, they were now taking return fire from the enemy's archers and long-range spells. The Republic's forces had already lost more than a third of their 13,000 troops. The upside was that the enemy's casualties were nearly double their own. Hilda's ultimate was giving the Republic a massive edge in combat. Combined with the massive disturbance that Sandman inflicted, the defenders were allowed to come out massively ahead in that trade. Underwood's grim mental arithmetic was suddenly interrupted when the floor underneath his feet shook mightily with a heavy roar. The entire stone keep that rested at the center of Fort Yemen rattled and creaked while dust fell out of the less-than-tidy ceilings and walls.
"The Black Tower just used his ultimate!"
someone yelled in the busy war room.
"I'm getting reports the south-facing wall is collapsing from the sudden earthquake!"
"We're pulling back!"
the legate decreed from the back of the room.
"Order the close-ranged fighters to break off the engagement and return to the keep at once."
Yes, sir,
came a chorus of replies. Flares shot into the air and orders barked into comm crystals as the entire room flew into action.
"Those on the walls and in the trees should focus on covering the vanguard's retreat, and then join them on their way inside the keep."
Yes, sir,
another division replied.
"Prepare the northwestern gate. Make sure it's ready to fly open the instant we need it to."
Yes, sir,
shouted a third group of elves.
"Perfect. Let's arm our little surprise."
"On it, sir,"
Vera replied in a spirited manner. It was still a bit early, but the legate decided it was time to put the final phase of Operation Honeytrap into motion. Those close-ranged soldiers and adventurers under the effects of Tempest of Rage would get pincered and annihilated at this rate. Even if the ultimate gave them a massive edge in combat, which resulted in many casualties on the Empire's side, it didn't mean the Republic's fighters were invincible. Not to mention that none of the troops fighting on the southern side of the wall were under the effects of Hilda's skill. So the Republic had little hope of pushing them away on that front without significant losses. Prefect Vera anticipated this turn of events, as the cube in her hand was already showing Kira's face by the time Aiden had given her the order.
"What's Imiriel doing?"
Silas asked one of his assistants.
"Wasn't she supposed to keep that shaman away from our walls?"
"She had to withdraw once that staff-wielding angel returned, sir. She barely made it out of there alive."
"Damn,"
Silas cursed under his breath. That stubborn monk was a nuisance that nobody seemed capable of stopping. That wasn't entirely true, actually. Imiriel might have been able to do something about her, but not when she had to contend with two of the Empire's VIPs at once. She most likely wouldn't have been able to escape if the winged woman hadn't suddenly flown off after the Sandman. Her taking that opportunity to retreat to safety was the right choice. The Republic had already lost one irreplaceable asset at the monk's hands, and they were lucky to avoid another blow like that. Of course, none of that rationalization helped alleviate Underwood's urge to drive a knife right through that angelic bitch's face. The elf took a deep breath to rein in his seething emotions and asked in a deadpan voice,
"Any news regarding Fayhorn?"
"None, sir,"
came the expected answer.
"I see."
Even a high-leveled ranger wouldn't escape falling off from that high a drop unharmed after taking a blow to the head from that winged powerhouse. No amount of agility would allow someone to dodge the ground, after all. Even if he miraculously survived that drop, he would have been gravely injured and surrounded by the Empire. The only way he would still be alive was if he surrendered and let the enemy take him prisoner. However, Silas already knew that stubborn man would never allow such a thing. Milo Fayhorn was the sort of fool who would rather fight to his bitter last breath than be imprisoned in the Emperor's dungeons like some kind of war trophy. And since nobody had seen hide nor hair of him since his fall, then it was safe to assume he was already just another nameless corpse on the ground. Just another morsel on those dryad's dinner plate.
Well, at the very least we can add some seasoning. A grim and slightly sarcastic thought went through Silas's head before he focused his attention to coordinating the next phase of Operation Honeytrap. It may have been only for an instant, but in that brief moment, Underwood found he agreed with a certain unhinged catgirl's assessment of the Imperial Army as bags of high-grade fertilizer. Even after that flash of cruelty passed over him, he still felt a strong sense of resentment. He had some reservations regarding the wholesale slaughter of soldiers who were just following orders, but the only ones they could blame was their nation's leadership, who, rather ironically, would no doubt make for excellent plant food if they had been out here in the field. It was, after all, hard to describe the ones who had orchestrated this damned war as anything other than sacks of shit.
Part 7. Among the thousands of souls on the battlefield surrounding Fort Yemen was a certain elven druid, a man in his mid-30s with dark green eyes and hair, clad in a padded gray robe, held a gnarled wooden staff tipped with a globe carved out of jade. This individual had been drafted into the Republic's army along with his adventurer comrades. His role was primarily that of a healer, while the rest of his party consisted of a wizard to serve as a ranged attacker, a rogue charged with scouting, and a paladin to act as a vanguard. It was a balanced, flexible combination when it came to adventuring, but was ill-suited to open warfare. The wizard had no MP to spare for offense and focused entirely on providing cover for the druid and other Republic forces immediately around him with defensive magic. The paladin had gotten separated from the group during the chaos, and his teammates had no idea where he was or if he was even still alive. The rogue had completely failed to report back after her scouting assignment 4 days ago, which meant she was most likely either dead, captured, or a deserter. Regardless of the reason for her absence, it was unlikely they would see her any time soon, if at all. In short, the party was cut in half, and the most its last two members could offer the rest of their comrades in arms was support. Keeping as many people alive as possible was hardly what one would call glorious, but it was the best use of their combined magic. It was hardly fitting to the wizard's specialization, though. The man was one of the hundreds of humans who'd been drafted into the Third Legion to stand against the Empire. While some of his people had refused the draft and were summarily deported or imprisoned, this man would have chosen to stand against his former countrymen regardless. He was in his early 20s, his scalp shaved bald, and bore a cross-shaped scar on his right cheek. These made him look much older and meaner than he actually was. He had a robe identical to his druid companions, but used a short, copper-plated wand instead of a staff. Wands were a type of magic item that did not boost their wielder's magical power, but funneled it into a ranged weapon. Channeling one's MP through the short rod would allow the user to instantaneously invoke a singular magical attack that would change depending on the make and material of the wand. Streams of fire, shards of ice, and sprays of acid were but a small fraction of what a wand was capable of.
Elyon!
The wizard called out.
Healing rain!
The elf finished his chant.
What is it, Notley?
The two of them were practically back-to-back, yet they still had to shout with all their might if they hoped to be heard over the cacophony of the battle.
It's the signal!
Elyon shifted his field of vision upward and to the side, confirming that a series of bright red flares had been launched into the air from the keep's turrets.
That quake from earlier must have knocked down the walls,
he muttered, as his feet carried him back through the sand-filled gap in the wall. He knew that event had been no natural occurrence. The force behind it was exceptional, and the elf was quite positive those tremors were probably felt kilometers away. At the same time, the power behind it was oddly focused and contained. It was most definitely caused by a person, and a troublesome one at that. The level 42 druid had, at the time, reflexively used a mend soil spell to try and calm down the angry ground beneath his feet. However, this action was about as fruitful as a child trying to stop a landslide with a toy shovel. This gap in power proved that the one causing those tremors had a much, much higher natural affinity than his own. and the culprit behind it was unquestionably that shaman ranker mentioned in the briefing. After all, natural affinity was an advanced attribute similar to faith in that only certain jobs, namely druids, shamans, and monster tamers, had access to it. Unlike faith, however, it showed one's devotion when it came to serving and protecting the natural world, as opposed to furthering some deity's agenda. This difference in perspective was the reason those three naturalist jobs sometimes butted heads with the clergy comprised of paladins, monks, and priests. Well, the Republic was a place where such quarrels didn't really happen. Unlike other deities, the teachings of Nairi almost completely aligned with the interests of those godless pagans. That's why Elion and his paladin comrade got along far better than one might expect. The elf quickly scanned his surroundings, but did not see that reliable man's figure anywhere. Then again, the Republic's retreat was not exactly orderly, so it was quite difficult to spot a specific individual, especially with everyone wearing the same colors. He and his wizard friend had already made it inside the wall and had some breathing room. The absolutely wrecked state of the southern fortifications showed the druid's hunch was spot on. It wasn't a small gap either, as pretty much the entire stone structure bridging the gaps between the two southernmost hilt trees had turned to rubble.
Here, clarity potion,
Notley offered the distracted druid.
Yeah, thanks.
The druid accepted the crystal vial filled with milky liquid and downed it in one go. It was a sickeningly sweet concoction that quadrupled the user's automatic MP recovery rate, but its effects ended the instant said user invoked a spell or activated a skill. It was more or less useless during combat, but was a cost-efficient way of drastically shortening downtime between fights.
You think Durothil survived?
The hopeful wizard asked.
I was just thinking about that. Normally I'd say yes, but seeing him flip out like that, I honestly can't say.
The calm and stoic paladin charging into enemy lines while screaming, "Fucking kill," was unexpected, to say the least. It would seem that the Tempest of Rage not only boosted one's physical performance, but could also have adverse effects on their psyche. The vast majority of Republic troops could handle the influx of anger, but a few of them, such as the elf named Durothil, had gone mad with rage. No, perhaps this was merely their pent-up and repressed resentment finally boiling over beyond their ability to hide or control it. Notley might not have noticed, but Elion was certain that Durothil had taken the sudden absence of their female rogue quite hard. Miria was his sister, so it was only natural her disappearance would leave the paladin disturbed and distraught.
Look alive, people!
A clear voice rang out over the buzzing crowd, which immediately went silent. This was a natural reaction, as the one speaking was a centurion, a mid-ranking officer in the Republic's army. One could easily tell his station by the large, crescent-shaped brush on his helmet and the knee-length cloak on his back, both of which were black in color. He'd look like just another rank-and-file legionnaire without those trappings.
"The enemy will be upon us in minutes," he continued shouting. "Everyone here is to head inside the keep and aid in its defense. Those who can use magic or attack from a distance are to occupy the south and east-facing turrets and towers and hold your fire. I repeat, all of you are to hold your fire at all costs. The rest of you line up the walls and deter the enemy from scaling up them. You are to focus on defense and stall the enemy as much as possible, just as before. Now, move!"
"Yes, sir!"
came a chorus of disorganized voices. A number of wizards flew into the air with magic, many carrying their allies up to the fortifications. A wizard's flight spell was very tricky to control, to the point where very few wizards could use it competently in combat. Well, not unless they had the aerial combat skill like Imiril. Unfortunately, that was a skill only available at level 65 of the job, and very few of them had had the chance to learn it yet. The same applied to the level 36 wizard named Notley, who floated upwards with Elion clinging to his back.
"Hold your fire," he says,
he grumbled with a click of his tongue.
"That's my bloody specialty."
"Hey, at least you're not a pyromancer,"
pointed out the druid with a humorless grin.
"Otherwise, you'd be almost completely useless."
"Yeah, I guess. Still, it's odd that we were told not to use fire.
The higher-ups probably have some strategy in mind.
Something involving those green kids?
Notley jerked his head towards the still smoldering hilt tree that got enveloped by dragonfire earlier.
Probably. However, I wouldn't really put too much stock in...
The elf's voice trailed off as he squinted at the crowd far below his feet.
Huh? Xurathil? Notley, look! He's alive!
He is? Where?
The wizard stopped the two's ascent and his eyes followed Elyon's outstretched finger. It pointed directly at a heavily armored elf among the crowd of Republic troops making their way into the keep. His gilded and inscribed equipment was either horribly dented or outright cut through in several places. The gray tabard on his chest, bearing a black eagle, was dyed red with blood. He had lost his helmet along the way, revealing his scruffy brown hair and a fresh scar across his face. He was missing an eye, limping heavily, and his right arm hung loosely from his shoulder, but he still carried himself with an air of dignity.
"Well, I'll be damned,"
the wizard smirked.
"Quick, drop me off and go pick him up."
"Huh? But he's so heavy."
"Notley, he's injured. He's not climbing up all those steps without aid."
Elyon stated the obvious.
"Fine, but you're paying for the next round of clarity potions."
"Whatever, just go."
The druid dismounted from his teammate's back, landing atop one of the four corner towers of the keep. Notley returned to the ground to pick up their no longer missing comrade as Elyon silently watched over the Empire's movements from his vantage point. The tower was a 20-meter tall structure, which made it one of the highest points in the area, barring the five gigantic hilt trees' branches. Needless to say, it gave him a rather unobstructed view of what was happening on the ground. Now, Elyon wasn't a ranger or anything, but even he could tell how screwed his side was. The Empire's soldiers regrouped and reformed ranks. It was only a matter of seconds before they started flooding through the holes in the walls to completely surround the keep and block off any hope of escape. This naturally narrowed down his options for the future to being killed in action or taken prisoner. Unlike certain overly zealous individuals, he wouldn't hesitate to pick the latter if he was allowed to choose. After all, if there was anything the natural world had taught him over the years, it was the ability to survive no matter what.
"Still, those dryads really had too little impact,"
he muttered under his breath.
"I know they probably don't care much about us elves, but they should be able to do more than that catapult garden, right?"
Honestly speaking, while the appearance of those dryad quintuplets had been quite awe-inspiring, their effectiveness had been anything but. Elyon was one of many druids assigned to tending to those hilt seedlings in the initial stages of the siege, so he had more insight into the matter than the vast majority of his allies. Flinging rocks over the walls was a creative use of their power, and probably could have done a lot more damage if they didn't chew through ammunition so quickly. Granted, he didn't see firsthand what damage those rocks actually did, but he doubted their effect on the battle had been all that significant. Was that really the extent of those legendary creatures' abilities, though? It certainly seemed like it, considering the way those green kids, as Notley called them, both looked and acted completely like innocent children. Naive ones with poor judgment to boot. It was bad enough they were following around a beastkin, of all things, but incessantly calling her mummy? That was downright preposterous. Outrageous. Heretical, even. Incidentally, he wasn't having such bitter thoughts just because they completely ignored him when he tried to introduce himself. This and that were completely unrelated. His envy aside, there was also the possibility that the higher-ups were keeping a lid on those dryads' true purpose in this siege. If they hit a trump card of some sort, they would not dare show it to grunts like Elyon. That just begged for the information to leak out, after all. It was widely believed that Underwood Fellow had done everything in his power to weed out the Empire's spies among the Third Legion's ranks. However, the veteran druid had no doubt that a few of them slipped through the cracks regardless.
"Elyon! I'm back!"
Notley returned with the near-crippled Durothil on his back. The wizard's face glistened with sweat, showing just how heavy his comrade and his equipment truly were. Elyon abandoned his attempts to analyze things far above his pay grade and proceeded to apply his healing magic to his longtime friend. even if his HP recovered, the fact he had fractured bones was a problem. Long-lasting injuries like those did not heal as quickly as battle wounds, and would take weeks to recover without magic. Although Durathil may have been a paladin, he lacked the means with which to heal himself. He fancied himself a warrior who focused on martial combat while championing Nairi's name, so he hadn't branched out into the magical aspects of his job. In the first place, paladins didn't usually have a lot of intelligence or wisdom, so said spells would be quite weak under normal circumstances. Well, that Mithril gnome in the fort had healing magic as potent as a priest's, but that was mostly because she had gained a good deal of those two attributes from her artificer job. That and her fanatical devotion to that loony god of hers probably meant she had an abnormally high amount of faith. After all, it was an attribute that could easily be raised or lost depending on the individual's actions, same as Elyon's natural affinity.
"Sorry for taking off like that,"
Durathil grumbled while the druid treated his arm.
"I know. You couldn't help it. That tempest of rage got the better of you, didn't it?"
"Yeah."
"Did you at least make those guys suffer for taking Myria?"
butted in Notley.
Yeah. I must have killed about a dozen men out there. Not my proudest moment, though. I lost my weapons somewhere along the way, but just charged at the enemy with my bare fists. I'd probably have died out there if not for the Sandman."
"The Sandman? You saw him?"
"I didn't just see him, Notley. I felt him."
"That's gay,"
the wizard said jokingly.
"Really, Notley? Really?"
the druid complained.
"It's fine, Elyon."
Durathil calmed him. The three of them shared a moment of silence while the people around them prepared for the next part of the siege.
"So, what happened with the Sandman?"
Elyon inquired.
"Well, most of an Imperial soldier landed on me."
"What?"
the other two blurted out.
"Like, just the upper half. Everything below the man's waist was missing. Like it was ripped off or something. See this blood? This isn't mine."
The paladin pointed to the red stains on his tunic. Looking at it closer, it wasn't just blood, but several bits were also stuck to the fabric, causing his comrades to dry heave out of disgust. It wasn't like they were particularly squeamish or anything, but as backliners, they weren't nearly as accustomed to gore as a vanguard like Durathil.
"So, anyway, being hit with that mess sobered me up a little, and I noticed that bits and pieces of people were flying all over the place. I looked around for the source, and I saw that guy from the rumors towering over the crowd, mercilessly chasing down the humans as they ran for their lives."
"Running for their lives?"
said Notley while raising an eyebrow.
"I highly doubt Imperial soldiers would do something shameless like that."
"No. You don't understand, man. That Sandman, he's fucking terrifying. A single glance at him made my skin crawl. I can't imagine what it was like for the ones that were right next to him. I'm just glad he's on our side."
"Sounds like despair or a warlock skill,"
noted the learned wizard.
"Oh yeah, he's definitely a warlock. Had his demons out and everything. Still, to send so many people fleeing at once, that's no ordinary warlock, huh?"
Elyon remarked.
"I'll say. The fear and anxiety from just seeing his blood-drenched form from afar completely overpowered my anger and fully brought me back to my senses. The enemy was so busy withdrawing, they just left me knocked over by half a corpse on the ground while they fled for their lives. I got trampled a bit, but hardly the worst that could have happened to me if that man hadn't appeared."
"I see,"
Elyon sighed.
"I guess we owe that guy one, huh?"
"Yeah, most definitely,"
Notley agreed.
"Either way, good job on making it back,"
the druid added as he finished treating the last of Durathil's broken bones. He also healed the large scar on his face, but the eye seemed like a lost cause.
"We're not out of the woods yet."
The paladin jerked his head southward. The Empire had begun their push towards the keep and poured through the holes in the wall. The catapult garden that Elyon had worked so hard on was trampled underfoot. They also spotted the shaman called the Black Tower, the very obvious culprit behind that earthquake from earlier. The man stood out like a sore thumb, so it was rather impossible not to notice him.
Well, I guess I better go make myself useful.
Durathil stood up and was about to head down the steps to the walls below, but Notley stood in his way with crossed arms, clearly intent on keeping him from doing anything stupid.
And how exactly do you plan on fighting without weapons?
I saw Frankie on the way up. He'll hook me up with some of his spare gear.
The paladin forcefully shoved his concerned teammate aside and strode off without looking back. The wizard wanted to go after him, but Elyon stopped him by grasping his shoulder with a spare hand.
Leave him alone, Notley. He has his duty, and we have ours.
The man let out a heavy sigh, then said,
Have I mentioned I fucking hate this war, by the way?
Only about 87 times, but who's counting?
The two of them shared a brief chuckle before turning their attention to the oncoming Imperial troops. It wasn't long before the two sides started exchanging spells and projectiles in earnest once more. At some point, a fully healed Hilda leapt off the ramparts and cut a bloody swath through the enemy force before engaging the Black Tower in one-on-one combat. Imiril was having a mid-air duel against that angelic monk that Elyon saw fly overhead a few times, though it seemed more like a glorified game of cat and mouse. As for Elyon, he was sitting cross-legged in the center of the tower's roof and focusing on his tranquil presence skill. It was something that steadily restored the HP and MP of those around him, letting them fight for longer. Notley the wizard was finally free to hurl spells at his opponents, although he had to stick to ice-based magic due to the Centurion's orders from earlier. The rest of the magic users and archers on the tower did much the same, while the keep's barrier-generating magic item kept them safe from harm for the moment. Down on the ground, the Imperial troops gradually encircled the keep from all sides. Many of them lugged around steel-tipped battering rams to break down the doors on the east side. Others tried clambering up the walls either under their own power or by using tools such as grappling hooks and siege ladders. The ban on fire-based magic was quite evident and a serious handicap in that respect. Not only were such spells naturally devastating against living creatures, but they could easily turn that siege equipment into ash and cinders.
Freezing beam!
A pure white beam shot out of Notley's hand, aimed loosely at the crowd underneath. It brilliantly bounced off some magical barrier or another, dealing a grand total of fuck-all damage.
Okay, then let's try chain lightning!
A flash of purple electricity arced out of his fingertips. It did even less than his previous attempt.
Damn it. It's just not good enough,
he grumbled under his breath. Even if wizards could use a multitude of elements, each individual was naturally inclined to focus on one, maybe two of them through skill choices and mastery training. There were several reasons for this, but chief among them was one's elemental aptitude. No one understood why or how, but it was a known fact that certain individuals were naturally more gifted when weaving magic of a specific element. However, while playing to one's natural strength was expected, it also meant that other flavors of magic would lag behind and fail to improve.
Give it up, Notley!
His teammate called out to him.
Just put your mana shield up already!
The wizard glanced up to see something like cracks forming in the air, a clear sign that the keep's innermost barrier was about to break. As much as he disliked going on the defensive, he had to admit it was a much better use of his MP than throwing those pathetic spells around. He still made sure to click his tongue in frustration as he and several others layered the defenses in preparation of that barrier breaking. However, they would soon find out that this preemptive course of action was unnecessary. A loud, deep something echoed throughout the besieged fort. The bizarre noise was somewhere halfway between a groan and a roar that rapidly rose in volume. Those with trained ears and senses could tell that this disturbance had not one, not two, but five distinct sources, all making the same noise at that same pitch. Scouts on both sides of the conflict then started keeling over as the mysterious voices became loud enough to deafen their sensitive ears. Moments later, pretty much everyone else in the area followed suit. People of all races and vocations were momentarily paralyzed by the deafening noise that seemed to rattle them down to their very bones. Even the four surviving VIPs were nearly driven to their knees as the insufferable noise drilled into their skulls. It wasn't just the air vibrating, however. The ground shifted and undulated unnaturally, causing more than a few people to lose their footing and fall over. Several gigantic roots burst out of the dirt, completely sealing the holes in the walls and trapping roughly 3/4 of the Empire's remaining forces inside the fort. The cry that seemed to split the very air apart suddenly stopped, and a heavy silence hung over the battlefield. Combatants on both sides hastily rebuilt their formations, yet none of them dared to utter so much as a peep. Their bodies and minds reflexively tensed up as they scanned their surroundings. For even though only a handful of individuals knew what was about to happen, none of those men and women believed even for a second that the auditory assault was the end of it. A chorus of bizarre sounds came from outside the wall. It was short, abrupt, and sounded like a whole lot of something happened simultaneously. Barely a second later, the noise repeated itself, followed closely by a scream. Lots of screams, actually. That dreadful noise rang out once again, this time accompanied by the sound of full-blown panic. It was painfully clear that something was attacking the Imperial soldiers beyond the walls, but those on the inside could not fathom what it might be based on the auditory clues alone. Zone, having regained her senses, spread her wings and immediately bolted upwards. She was already up and over the wall before anyone could do anything to stop her. What she saw on the other side of those roots was something that could only be described as one thing. A bloodbath. She turned around in the air and stared silently at the soldiers on the ground. Her trademark ice-cold expression shattered, and her face showed a mix of spite, anger, and fear. What she just witnessed was something she could neither fully comprehend nor handle. But she still wanted to do something. Anything. But what? What could she possibly do against that? Her mind spun along at great speeds looking for an answer, but came to a grinding halt when she realized the ghastly noises had stopped, leaving behind nothing but a heavy silence. It was a sign that whatever powers were at work here were finished with the people outside. This meant that they would undoubtedly move onto the inside. Hundreds of slim roots sprang up from the ground. Each fully impaled a single Imperial soldier from below. Metal, flesh, and bone were pierced completely as if made of jelly. The targets were chosen seemingly at random, and they all let out that terrifying sound at the same time. A few of the sturdier ones clung onto life, letting out a few disgusting noises or spurts of blood before the spear-like roots retreated into the ground with the same blinding speed with which they appeared. It wasn't until the humans' punctured bodies, living or otherwise, hit the ground that their allies began to realize the grim scene in front of their eyes was, unfortunately, a reality. A second wave of spears followed the first one almost immediately. The Imperial soldiers flew into an uncoordinated panic. How were they supposed to fight an enemy that used the very ground beneath their feet as a shield? Several of them realized the trees were at fault and started attacking them in earnest. However, a hilt tree's iron bark was not to be underestimated. That tough natural armor effortlessly absorbed any and all attacks and spells that came at it. A few managed to chip or singe it, but that was it. The human wizards realized resistance was futile and immediately followed Zone's example and bolted into the air.
Shoot down the flyers!
A commanding voice rang out within the Republic's stupefied ranks. Adventurers and soldiers felt their bodies jolt as if struck by lightning and immediately targeted the flying spellslingers.
The humans who tried to flee through the air were riddled with wounds and lost their lives in an instant. Those closer to the outside wall, Zone included, escaped the Republic's death trap with their metaphorical tails between their legs.
Hold!
The same voice rang out atop the keep walls, clearly audible over the chaos beneath. The Republic troops followed it without question and halted their attacks. It was quite clear by this point this is what their superiors plotted, so all they had to do was simply obey those orders and pray they were not next on the chopping block. They just silently watched the Empire's plight with a mixture of horror, fear, and awe. It was like being in the eye of a hurricane of death. None of them dared to move or even utter a peep, lest they raise the ire of their betters. Many of them tried closing their eyes, but that was somehow worse. It just made that horrible sound even more pronounced. It took a mere 2 minutes to completely decimate nearly 15,000 people. Their mangled corpses and discarded weapons littered the ground. The upturned and hole-filled soil eagerly drank up all their oozing blood, and the terrain inside Fort Yemen's walls became a bloody swamp. There was a loud rumble as the giant roots that prevented the soldiers' retreat sank back into the ground, revealing the scenery beyond them was just as gruesome. The only survivors outside the keep were the handful of the Republic's troops who had leapt off the walls after following Hilda's questionable example, the dwarven berserker herself, and the man known as the Black Tower. He didn't know it yet, but the shaman's habit of going around topless had miraculously excluded him from the dryad's game of pop the blue things.
So, Elyon?
Notley muttered, struggling to find his voice.
What?
The druid had, almost without thinking, gotten right up next to his friend at the edge of the tower, a macabre curiosity urging him to get a better view of what was happening below. It was a decision he regretted immensely at the moment.
What were you saying about those dryads earlier? That they were weaker than expected?
The elf nodded slowly, his face steadily turning pale.
So, how does it feel to be wrong for once?
The wizard asked. Elyon vomited violently over the side of the tower in response.
Yeah, that's, about right.
Notley could only sympathetically pat him on the back, while doing his absolute best to keep his own breakfast down. He failed. Epilogue. Somewhere deep beneath the earth, yet at the same time hundreds of meters up in the sky, a consciousness stirred. It saw without eyes, breathed without lungs, heard without ears, tasted without a tongue, and groaned without a mouth. As it rose from a century-spanning slumber that felt like hours, it once again reached out and grasped for its inherited memories. Except this time around, it was in no rush, and it pieced together the precious mental fragments slowly and carefully.
This time?
A troubling thought passed through that peculiar mind. Was this truly the first time it had awoken? For some strange reason, it had the nagging feeling this was not the case. How else would the words, this time, come up so naturally, without it even doubting them? It slowly and meticulously studied those inherited memories that were both foreign and its own, and after several months of dissecting them over and over, it arrived at the answer.
I don't remember.
Granted, not the best answer, but it was still the only one available to it.
Deciding that mulling over things it could do nothing about was fruitless, it pushed that nagging feeling away and instead focused on the task at hand. Objectively speaking, delaying it any more at this stage was neither good nor bad. But it felt lonely. It wanted to get out there and meet its kin. Thus, the sea of thoughts, memories, and sensations converged and coalesced. The muddy, seemingly endless mindscape steadily shrank to a single point, which threatened to burst under the pressure. And then, the dryad opened her eyes. The other half of the existence known as a hilt tree stirred much like her host and home. Painfully, agonizingly, slowly, she rose up from one of her branches, taking an entire day to completely emerge from its bark. And then, she blinked several times in rapid succession as she once again checked through those implanted thoughts that were centuries, possibly even millennia old.
Ah, in the end, something still feels off.
She spoke with a voice so sweet that it could give someone a toothache. She reached up to the sides of her head with both hands and felt antlers growing out of it. Her fingers traced the signs of her adulthood to her vine-covered scalp, and she gently ran her fingers through the hair-like vegetation dangling from it. Then, on some strange impulse, she patted herself. It made her unexpectedly happy, but also frustrated at the same time.
Hmm? This isn't quite right either.
Her eyes drifted idly over the area, her high vantage point giving her an unobstructed view for kilometers around. Well, except for her trunk behind her and the lush canopy overhead. The ground underneath her shade was dominated by a sprawling city. Structures built out of wood, stone, and brick were densely packed around her protruding roots or dotted around her trunk. Various beings, both humanoid and not, milled about at a pointlessly rapid pace. This was, of course, merely a matter of perspective, for that dryad spent several days staring idly into the distance without really noticing either the passage of time or the lives of those tiny and insignificant creatures. She yawned mightily, causing her perception of time to rapidly accelerate to the point where her seconds were of the same length as those of the real world.
Mm-hmm. That's better,
she said with a chipper voice. She stretched her arms out, twisted her waist, and squatted a few times to limber up her thoroughly dull body.
Well then, I suppose I should see if any of the others are up yet.
The dryad known as Birchus sank back into her branch and appeared within a certain safe space. It was inside her neighbor and sister's trunk, yet still had fresh leaves and vines covering most of the walls and ceiling, while the floor was left bare and relatively flat.
Lily!
She called out.
Are you awake?
Slowly but surely, another dryad rose from the ground. Her appearance was identical to that of Birchus in every conceivable way, apart from her thoroughly drowsy expression and vacant stare. The newly arrived dryad blinked a few times and yawned before her apparent sleepiness went away.
Oh. Morning, Birchus. You're up too? Yup. I think it's just you and me for the moment, though.
Lily yawned again.
Guess the others should be waking up soon too, huh? Probably. Then, shall we wait for them? Might as well.
The two sisters went to lie down on the floor, and two beds of soft grasses and leaves sprouted out of the hard and gnarled bark to provide comfort. The dryads just sort of lazed around for a few hours until Pinea, Castelia, and Terenia showed up. They all greeted each other happily, and the latter three took after the former two's example and also lay down on improvised bedding.
I have a nagging feeling that something's wrong,
Pinea muttered.
I was just thinking that. Yeah, me too. Same here.
The others were quick to confirm they felt it as well. Something was, for lack of a better word, off. The quintuplets had known each other for a mind-boggling amount of time, yet the silence that hung in that room was unnatural, awkward, The air in the room steadily shifted to a more thoughtful atmosphere as the five dryads hemmed and hawed in an effort to figure out what caused this anomaly. Though their shared, stunted growth likely left each of them dumber than the average dryad, there was nothing they couldn't solve if they put their heads together.
"Now that I think about it,"
Lily spoke,
"how come all of you decided to gather here? I mean, why my trunk of all places?"
The others furrowed their brows, trying to come up with a reason.
"It just felt right, I guess,"
Terenia offered.
"Yep, yep."
Castelia vigorously nodded her head.
"Hmm? Wait, did you two always get along this well?"
Burgess asked.
"Why wouldn't we?"
the pair answered together.
"Wasn't there something about sharing the sunlight being a problem? But our branches and leaves are as intermingled as our roots by now, so that can't possibly be the case,"
Castelia stated with a dismissive wave of her hand.
"I guess so. Besides,"
she added,
"Mr. Sun shines down on all of us. His light and warmth are things that should be shared."
Her voice gradually diminished as she realized the words that came out of her own mouth were somehow not her own.
"Oh? Castelia says some wise things, huh?"
Lily remarked.
"I guess you learn a thing or two after being burned so badly, huh?" "Burned? Yeah. Didn't your canopy get... wait, what?"
No matter how one looked at Castelia, she was perfectly healthy and impossible to differentiate from her other siblings by sight alone.
"Come to think of it, how come we're all lying on these beds?"
Pinea spoke up next.
"I mean, it's comfy, but it's strange, isn't it?"
The group once again went silent as they sank deep into thought. The fragmented and deteriorated mementos of a distant past floated inside their minds. Trying to dredge up those lost memories was ultimately pointless, and their efforts only served to make them aware of an inexplicable void, a mysterious longing they couldn't quite nail down. At the very least, there was progress, as they were finally able to pin down the nature of that unpleasant feeling they'd all shared since waking up.
"Someone's missing!"
they spoke in unison while staring at the empty space in the middle of their five-pointed formation.
"I want to be patted on the head,"
Burgess stated, and was met with many affirmative nods.
I want to play with fuzzy leaves,"
Lily chimed in, much to the approval of her sisters.
"I want to take a nap in someone's lap,"
Terenia lamented, and the others understood her completely.
"I want to be hugged,"
Pinea selfishly demanded, though none of the other quintuplets could fault her for it.
"I want to pop the blue things,"
Castelia shouted, prompting a round of soft applause. The impromptu dryad conference once again fell into silence. This one lasted for only a few seconds rather than the several days that the other lulls in the conversation had taken.
"Say, Lily?"
Pinea pointed at the wall opposite her.
"What's that? Hmm? That's my heartwood, silly. No, I mean that. There's something there, see?"
All of them turned their eyes towards where their sister was pointing. Lily waved her hand and cleared some of the vegetation blocking the view, allowing them all to see the oddity that Pinea had spotted. Carved into that dryad's most precious place were a series of symbols. Although they looked like doodles and random scribbles, they were actually the letters of a language. A certain ancient tongue no mortal could decipher on their own, and was far older than any of those five ladies. Yet, they understood that writing's meaning instantly. "Mummy loves you."
"Mummy!"
they screamed in unison. Both happiness and sadness swelled up within them as the memories of those precious few days flooded back into their minds. How could they have forgotten? They were the ones that asked that relentlessly cheerful cat girl to leave those words behind in the first place. They would have undoubtedly burst into tears by now, if dryads were capable of such a thing. And then the emotional burst of nostalgia steadily faded, giving way to a grim realization.
"That wasn't our real mummy, was it? Well, yeah, she wasn't a dryad, or even an elf. I don't think she was a person at all, come to think of it. She was really nice and kind to us, though. Yeah, she played a lot with us, even though she didn't have to. Took care of us, too. Those blue things she gave us were delicious. Hmm? That's not how I remembered that bit. Pioneer has a point. It was the red juice inside the blue things that was the delicious part, right? Yeah. There were plenty of white things that were the same on the inside of those shells. But Mummy said not to touch anything but the blue ones. Wonder what was up with that. Maybe the other ones weren't ripe yet. Oh, that makes sense. Yep, yep. Seems right.
The quintuplets' mood rose significantly as they let nostalgia overwhelm them once again. Even if they had grown physically, their mental state had barely moved on from their former childish selves, a problem that would naturally correct itself with the passage of time, now that they were awake.
I still think popping them was the best part, though. Very fun. I completely agree. Personally, I think that game of catch was better. Yeah, throwing things was also fun. I still want to play with something fuzzy, though.
The dryads chatted back and forth for a while, before they realized one of them had suddenly gone completely quiet.
What's wrong, Castelia?
Asked Terenia.
I feel itchy,
she answered while scratching her midriff. Those three simple words set off a cascade of complaints.
Come to think of it, I feel quite itchy too. Me too. I don't really itch, but some of my roots feel numb. I'm totally fine, by the way. Say, back when Birchus itched, it was because of those stupid bugs, right? Yeah. Them again. Let's go check.
The five of them decided this was no time to mope around, and they immediately transported themselves through their intertwined roots and branches until they reached the source of Castelia's itchiness. As expected, they found a bustling termite nest that was selfishly burrowing under her bark.
Ugh!
Groaned their victim.
Nasty, nasty things! Do not want!
The cavity inside her own trunk instantly filled with dozens of thick, heavy vines that moved around like the tentacles of a giant octopus. Castelia tried crushing, smashing, and entrapping those infuriating vermin, but failed to do much. The termites either squirmed or bit through her grasp, or outright evaded her whip-like attacks. She felt proud of herself after she finally managed to kill three, but then got depressed when she noticed there were thousands of them left.
Oh, this is hopeless!
She despaired while pulling on her antlers as if she was trying to rip them out.
It's okay, sis. We'll help. Yeah, let's all work together.
However, despite their enthusiasm, the total termite death tally after an entire day of work was around 60. They tried everything their implanted knowledge provided them, including poisoning the air and flooding them out, but none of it worked. The quintuplets decided to momentarily retreat to the safe room inside Lily and rethink their approach.
Say, how did Birchus's itching go away back then?
Asked Pioneer.
Mum, I mean, Kirira?
The dryad in question stammered.
I think just calling a mummy is fine. Oh, I agree. Mummy is mummy. Anything else feels like an insult. Besides, we never really asked for her name, so it's pointless to try and remember it. Yeah, don't force yourself. Ahem.
Birchus cleared her throat.
Okay, then. Mummy led some people inside my bark, and they killed them all with fire.
Oh!
The others groaned in unison at hearing the F word. Even if that element was somewhat of a natural enemy for them, they could easily deal with it given time, as long as it wasn't dragon fire. Even the endlessly tenacious hilt trees couldn't survive if repeatedly bombarded with that stuff. Few things could withstand the destructive breaths of those living calamities, after all. The problem at hand was that those bugs probably reproduced at a rate where killing a mere 60 in a day didn't even make a dent in their numbers. If they were going to try exterminating them, it needed to be done in one fell swoop. But fire was out of the question since the dryads had no idea how to make it.
We could try popping them,
Pioneer suggested.
That might work, but they're not blue. So, we can still pop things even if they're not blue, right?
Ah!
that's right,
the other four exclaimed in unison.
But won't Mummy be mad? I don't think Mummy's still around, Tyrinia. Oh, right.
I miss her so much.
Yeah.
All of them solemnly stared at their feet as they grieved for that creature that had passed away by now. This sad scene was the reason why dryads tended to shy away from contact with the world at large. Getting overly attached to someone destined to die off long before they did would just result in a gaping wound in their metaphorical hearts. Thankfully for these five, they could console each other, which would help them get over their shared loss fairly easily. That would only come later, leaving the tree ladies feeling very hurt indeed at the present.
Well, if Mummy's not around, then we can do what we want, right?
Yeah, Lily has a point. Let's go pop those nasty things.
Yeah!
The five of them returned to that crawling cavity and began focusing on the needles. First, they opened long, narrow tunnels within the termite-infested timber. Inside those holes, they formed thin, dense spears out of solid, polished iron bark. The outcome was a weapon that could rival a masterwork spear forged out of the finest steel. A spring-loaded mechanism, also made of iron bark, was then added to the underside of it.
This is much harder to do than I remember,
complained Tyrinia.
Really? I think it's surprisingly easier this time around,
said Castelia with a casual tone.
Of course you do. We're inside your trunk, dummy. That's right, isn't it? Sorry, sis. It's fine, so long as you understand.
Still, to come up with this sort of thing, Mummy sure was amazing, ah.
Yup, yup,
came a chorus of affirmations and nods. The dryad's admiration of their mummy was genuine. They knew they would have never figured out how to make those needles all on their own. It had taken Boxy's unique perspective as a trap-loving, shape-shifting artificer to design a simple yet effective mechanism that even juvenile dryads could build and use. After all, even if the process through which a dryad moved and deformed vegetation was mechanically different from a doppelganger's shape-shifting, the end results were identical.
Ugh, this is tiring,
Castelia complained after a while.
How many did you girls make yet? 15, 18, 16, 4.
Tyrinia hung her head in shame, while Pinea gently did her best Kira impression by patting her on the head with a warm smile that said, "There, there," louder than any words. It was super effective, and her sister felt better right away.
What about you, Castelia?
Lily asked.
I made 60. Wow, talk about home ground advantage, huh? Okay, let's give this a try, shall we?
The overperforming dryad changed the subject.
Yeah!
Yet for all their enthusiasm and fist-pumping, the plant ladies found themselves briefly paralyzed with indecision.
How do we make sure we go at the same time without Mummy here?
Kira had been the one to coordinate their simultaneous attacks during the siege of Fort Yemen. The shapeshifter had insisted on doing so in an effort to instill horror and indecision in the Imperial troops. The plan had worked flawlessly, but the naive daughters remained blissfully unaware of the insidious motivations behind Mummy's instructions. From their perspective, it had all been part of the game.
How about we just sing the song? Oh, good idea!
The tune they referenced was something Boxy had come up with while it was bored and had nothing better to do. The former mimic had always enjoyed the tasty sounds known as music. That had been part of the reason why it had, at one point, developed something of an obsession with making music boxes. This had naturally progressed to the creature idly composing songs inside its head as a sort of hobby. Just something it could do to pass the time when social obligations kept it from doing anything useful or tasty.
But, how did it go again? Had something to do with stars, right?
This particular piece had been inspired by the special date Kira and Rowana had gone on before the former shipped out to the front lines. The view of those shiny dots in the distance framed by the darkness of the hilt tree canopy had given the monster a new appreciation of the night sky.
Ah, I remember now,
Burchess exclaimed. She shared the centuries-old memory of that strange song with her sisters, which in turn caused their own minds to vividly recall it. After muttering among themselves for a while, they turned their attention to the swarming mass of insects far below them and lined up next to each other. They closed their eyes and opened their mouths, took deep breaths, then let their combined voices rise as one.
Twinkle, twinkle, shiny star, how I wonder what you are. Up above the world so high, just a shiny in the sky. When the blasted sun is gone, when the nothing shines upon, then you show your tasty light, shiny, shiny all the night. Then the traveler in the dark, I will eat up like a shark. He would not see which way to go in the night when light is low. Though I know not how you taste, I will steal you with all haste. But I must learn how to fly and then reach you in the sky. Will you fit me like a ring? You'll be mine, you shiny thing. So until I reach that far, twinkle, twinkle, shiny star.
The tune was far slower and creepier than when Kira sang it, but it still did the job, as the last syllable of each line had been punctuated by a terrible shunk sound. When the dryads opened their eyes, they saw that hundreds, maybe even 1,000 termites were thoroughly popped. The stupid bugs kept crawling over the evenly spaced out holes in the timber, so the spring-loaded retractable needles were able to reap heavy casualties without the need to relocate them.
All right!
The plant ladies cheered together.
A shame we can't move the needles through the timber like we did through the soil,
one of them noted.
Yeah, this will still take forever. Why don't we just make some grooves in the timber?
Pinea suggested.
That's it!
The others shouted with great enthusiasm. Making those things was really hard since they had a bunch of thin, delicate parts, especially the firing mechanism. That sort of precise work was really difficult for the dryads, almost like trying to thread a needle from the other end of the room. If it was just about making passages to move the already constructed ironbark contraptions around, they could do that without even breaking a sweat. Pinea's idea worked splendidly, and the five dryads gained total dominance over those infuriating termites. Over the next few days, they thoroughly worked together to clean Castelia, Terenia, and Lily of their respective termite infestations. The thousands of bug carcasses were flushed out of their bodies and deposited somewhere deep into the ground, where they would become food for them later. In high spirits, they then went to investigate why Pinea's roots felt so numb. However, what they found was, in some ways, worse than the termites. Unbeknownst to them, an underground crime ring had taken up residence in the city's sewers. Although the elves had learned from their ancestors' mistakes and made sure to build them well out of the way of Pinea's roots, those people had purposefully dug them out. The purpose was quite clear, given the countless steel taps lined up along the unearthed limb's length, each actively draining the hilt tree's sap.
That's not yours!
The quintuplets yelled as they revealed themselves. The lone man that had been keeping an eye on things let out a panicked scream.
What's going on here?
The dark, dank chamber lit up as a group of six people rushed in through a door with lit mining helmets on their heads.
These girls just appeared out of nowhere!
The thugs and the dryads exchanged glances.
Holy shit, one of them exclaimed. Are those the dryad sisters? Like, the ones from the history books?
Since when can you read, dumbass?
My pop-pop read to me when I was little, okay?
This sap is not yours!
the plant ladies screamed.
Return all that you have taken at once!
What do we do, Larry?
One of the men asked.
Why are you asking me, boss?
You're the one who knows what those things are, right?
Kinda. I mean, sort of. I mean,
For fuck's sake, you're completely useless.
Ah, I remember now. It's okay, boss. Those dryads won't harm us elves, so we can just ignore their wailing.
The leader's eyes caught the intense rage within those weird women's eyes. It was far more convincing than his bumbling goon of a subordinate.
You sure about that, Larry?
Yep, positive. Though they're a bit different from what Pop-Pop told me.
Different? How?
Well, they're supposed to be completely green, but their hair is kind of... red.
Without hesitation, without warning, without holding back, and without even batting an eye, all of those insolent elves were pierced clean through. Only the guy who was originally there to keep an eye on the sap-tapping was spared. The five green faces in the room turned towards him, making him fall over and crawl away backwards while evacuating his bladder.
Return the sap!
They demanded.
I can't! I don't have it! I don't know where it is! I don't even know what they do with it or who they sell it to! Those buckets in the corner is all I have, I swear!
Pinea's sharp glare deviated from that of her sister's as she beheld the row of silver-plated buckets in question. She extended a tentacle-like vine from the side of her root, which shot forward and eagerly slurped up what was rightfully hers. However, it was far too little, and she was still losing sap from those metal taps lining her root. Well, now that she knew the cause, she could at least eliminate it. She furrowed her brows, squinting her eyes, and puffed up her cheeks as she strained. A few seconds later, the dozens of metal spouts stuck in her body were forcefully ejected, and the wounds they left behind healed up in an instant. She then slammed the vine into the cowering man, burying his mangled body into the dirt wall of the man-made cavern.
Ugh! Those vermin! I'll make them pay for this!
Some feeling returned to that particular root because of her intervention, but several others were still numb, most likely because they were receiving the same treatment. While that was bad in and of itself, it wasn't the actual reason she was ticked off. It was because those people deliberately attacked her. Termites couldn't help themselves. They were just following their instincts, so she could never truly bring herself to hate them. But those elves had gone out of their way to bleed her of her precious sap. To say it was an unforgivable act was an understatement.
Plinia?
Burgess muttered.
What is it?
She answered after calming herself down a bit.
That? Those ones weren't blue, right? No, they were black and brown. Why? So, how come so much juice came out?
What was arguably the smartest of the quintuplets turned her attention to the pools of blood flowing out of those criminals' bodies. Pinea's eyes shone, and she moved the vine she used to reclaim her sap to eagerly slurp up that red fluid.
Ah.
She sighed with a relieved face, her thunderous rage seemingly quenched.
Just as tasty as I remember it.
Really?
Asked the others.
Yeah. Actually, it might even be better.
No fair, you drank it all.
Yeah, I wanted a taste too.
Sorry.
Oh, I've an idea.
The city of Morgana was a historic settlement, named after a war hero of old and built under the shade of the only five red-leafed hilt trees in existence. A bustling population of over 18,000 souls had gathered under the uniquely beautiful and strangely mesmerizing plants. The city itself was along an important trade route, as well as a popular tourist destination, making it one of the most prosperous settlements on the continent. Yet, when the sun rose over it on one fateful day, it shone down on a gigantic field of rubble with nary a living person in sight. The only structure left intact and standing was an ancient monument of a female cat-eared beastkin covered in lush crimson flowers. This has been Morgana. Everybody Loves Large Chests, Volume 4. Written by Neven Ilyev. Narrated by Jeff Hayes. Featuring Annie Ellicott as Kira, Ruana, the Dryads, and the rest of the new female cast. Proofing by Dalton Lynn. Sound design by Jeff Hayes. Shiny Star sung by Annie Ellicott. Editing, mastering, music, and additional sound design by Ahmed Mahmoud. Copyright 2019 by Neven Ilyev. Production copyright 2019 by Neven Ilyev. A Sound Booth Theater production. For more awesome video game fiction, join the Gamelit Society Facebook group. To stay up to date on upcoming audiobooks or to see us perform live, join the Sound Booth Theater Live Facebook group or join our mailing list at soundbooththeater.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.